I am obsessed with the power of foods. I'm obsessed with foods. I love food, but I love the power of it. I love what it can do. And for me, bringing that to the world or bringing that to various different people and communities is something that I strive to do.
Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 8 of the Life Well Lived podcast. My name is Shane Breslin, and this show is all about navigating the challenges of life, being our best selves in the world, and ultimately living what might add up to a life well lived, one of fulfillment, of health, and of happiness. This week's conversation is about a topic very, very close to my heart, and that's food. Orla McLaughlin is an Irish nutritionist, and she is a deep well of wisdom when it comes to food. Full disclosure, I worked with Orla a couple of years ago after I met her at an event and heard her speak very compellingly about the relationship between gut health and mental health. At that time, I was in the early stages of my own journey towards taking every step I possibly could to better understand and better overcome my own depression. Working with Orla was a real eye-opener, and it helped me to transform my understanding of food and body weight and health and everything around that, and has without a doubt had far-reaching benefits for me ever since then. So given all that, it made sense for me at some stage during this podcast journey to sit down and have a chat with Orla about food and nutrition and what goes in our bodies. In this conversation, we hear how Orla's own health challenges stirred her interest in nutrition in the first place, and we go through the mass confusion around diets, from paleo to ketones, from plant-based to carnivore and everything in between. We talk about the importance of nutrition in relation to sleep and about the way the gut works. We also discuss calorie counts, macronutrients, intermittent fasting, and food as medicine. And Orla talks also about her work with families with autistic children. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you do, please do share it out with someone who might get something out of it. I'd be very, very grateful if you could take a screenshot on your phone or computer and post it onto your favorite social network. Enough of the introductions. On with the show, and nutritionist Orla McLaughlin. Orla McLaughlin, thank you so much for taking the time to meet me today. I try never to let an opportunity pass without thanking you for the very, very small bit of work we did together that you helped me with a couple of years ago. That was a very small amount of your time, but a big impact on my side. If we start at the start and kind of go back to your own background and how you got into nutrition, because it wasn't something that you kind of did from the very, very start of your, say, education, professional life. Tell us a little bit about kind of maybe your childhood and growing up and and eventually ending up in where you are now and your practice as a nutritionist.
Okay, so again, thank you so much for having me, and this is a brilliant opportunity for me, so I'm very grateful for it. For me, I guess my childhood, very, very normal childhood. I grew up on a farm in Donegal and was very, very aware of my food in terms of where it came from. Was my granny a lot, and you know, she grew her own potatoes and grew a lot of her own vegetables, and we ate a huge amount of that. So I was very aware of that. But as I was saying, I was also a child of the 80s, and convenience foods were coming in a huge amount. So, you know, I had my fair share of sugar sandwiches and microwavable meals and those kind of things as well. So I guess from a health perspective, when I was younger, a very active child, I played a lot of sports, football, swimming. We did a lot of music. And was just constantly outside a lot. It was never really inside. I was never a computer game TV person. So we were outside playing, kind of, I suppose, expending a lot of that energy. Then when I went, the only biggest thing that happened to me when I was younger from a health perspective is that I suffered a lot with sore throat. So I constantly had strep throat. And again, the protocol for that was a lot of antibiotics and things like that, which was absolutely fine. So that was something that plagued me a lot. And when the immune system started to get a bit lower, it was something that I kind of constantly was weakened for me. Then I went to, did Leaving Cert and went to Galway, went to NUIG and studied commerce and did that for 3 years. Loved it, absolutely loved it, but again, became a quite stressed person, became very, very anxious. And I thought it was just because of the environment that I was in terms of, and there's a lot of workload and meeting new people and all of those kind of things. But never did I ever think about the food that I was eating or not eating having an impact on that. And in the case for me, it was the food that I wasn't eating. So my diet was a very, very plain diet, very, very simple. It was pretty much white carbohydrate foods. It was pastas, it was potatoes, it was scones, so breads. the only vegetable that I pushed that I would eat was maybe sweet corn and sometimes peas. So again, there was very little greenery there. There was very little nutrition there. When I look back at the time, for me, it was food. It was normal. So did that, and then went to Wexford. So I worked there on a work placement course for 2 years in marketing practice. And then that was fine. And then from there, I left and came back and did a master's in marketing. And I absolutely loved that and really, really enjoyed the concept of consumer behavior and all of those kind of things, which a lot of it I would still use to this day. But again, really enjoyed that. Health-wise, again, became a little bit more anxious, stressed, anxiety, suffered a lot with panic attacks. But then I developed IBS. And I also developed this thing known as cyclical vomiting. So I'd randomly start to get sick. It didn't happen as much at the start, but then I went into quite a stressful job, and it just became really, really, really stressful for me. And I then, looking back, I knew that it was brought about by stress. So I'd randomly get up and get sick and then go into work, and that happened for a while. So for me, there was a huge amount then that I went, okay, what am I eating? What is causing this? What is doing this? And I had started studying nutrition at the time. So I was just then going into the final year of my master's at this stage in nutrition. And I ended up leaving my job and completely changing my diet, taking out through everything that I was learning. I was using myself as a tool. And I was applying what I knew onto myself, and that really, really helped. So I completely got rid of any of the allergen foods, and I got rid of anything that I thought was creating an upset in my digestive system. Turns out there was a lot, and it turns out it was a hard road, and there was a huge amount else that happened for me as well in terms of mental health. I wasn't as stressed as I previously was. I wasn't as anxious. I became a little bit less nervous and a little bit better able to cope in environments.
Had you left the job that you were stressed in?
I had left. So it was a 2-year master's, and in the final year I had left the job and just decided to do the master's in full time myself.
Okay. And so which do you think made a bit, like, in terms of making a bigger difference, or a fundamental difference, to was it the getting out of the stressful job, or the big changes you were making to your nutrition at that stage?
I would probably say a bit of both, because stress, and I never thought of stress as being an impact on daily life, but for me it was actually huge. I would never have, and even in that moment, hand on heart, I would never have said I was stressed out, but that was a stress on the body, getting up, getting sick, and then going into work. But I never thought about it that. It was just like, I get up, I go to work, and that's fine. So I pushed myself that wee bit more. So when I did leave, I noticed a huge difference in my ability to cope. And I didn't have that external environment contributing to, I guess, any more anxiety than I needed to have. So yes, to answer your question, I suppose I did notice a difference when that happened. I was a lot calmer in myself. I was better able to cope, and it gave me the headspace and the time to kind of figure out what I needed to do for my own health. Because had I gone down that path further, it wouldn't have led to a very nice road. So I definitely knew something kind of had to give. I was at that crossroads where I knew something had to give. So for me, it's brought me into a huge area in terms of digestive health and brain health. And I did my dissertation on the gut-brain connection between neurotypicals and children on the spectrum, which we can talk about a little bit further on. But definitely, even from a point of view of, you know, cognitive ability and Alzheimer's and preventative in terms of even mood and depression and things like that, there's a huge amount that happens in your gut first, and there's a huge amount that I figured out for myself as well that kind of helped me.
Right. And so, and when you say... Were you almost treating yourself in the early days of your study?
Absolutely, 100%. Absolutely. I call myself an evidence-based self-experimenter. You know, so if there's something there that I will, that I, you know, can see as evidence-based, I will definitely try it. Whether it's, you know, intermittent fasting, whether it's a ketogenic diet, whether it's giving up gluten, whether it's giving up dairy. And incidentally for me, I went to a really, really interesting talk by Dr. Jonathan Wright, and he had one big massive slide on the conference, and it said strep throat, lactose intolerance. And when I gave up milk, for me, I made a huge difference to my throat. I've never had a strep throat from then on. And you know, that was a big thing as well when we were growing up, because milk was associated with calcium. It is, and you know, I always had to take it for bone health, but it was actually causing a lot more damage to me then.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I jotted down evidence-based self-experimentation. Is the evidence both sides of that, in terms of you look for evidence before you start the experimentation, and then you weigh up the evidence of the experiment?
Absolutely.
And you do that for nutrition and food, or for lots of things?
For foods, for diet particularly, but also for in the autism community, in the ADHD community, I will often, you know, try things just to see in terms of format and administration of them. There's a huge amount of evidence in various different supplementation, but I will always try them myself in terms of how they are administered and what way that it's easiest for the child to take things, for example. It just makes it easier for me to recommend and be able to say, well, yeah, you can take it as an oil, or you can take it as a supplement, or you can take it as a capsule and break it into foods, whatever that may be.
Yeah.
So I always try and do that first for clients, because at least then they know exactly what I know what I'm dealing with.
Yeah, it brings us to one of the things I wanted to chat about, and why not go there now, is the what seems to be kind of mass confusion around kind of food, nutrition, diets. Like, almost everywhere I look, you hear or see different people advocating different things completely at one end of the spectrum. You see somebody like, I don't know, Jordan Peterson, somebody I've seen recently talking about kind of the full carnivore diet, and he's changed his whole diet and he eats nothing but meat, and within 6 months he was probably within 1 month he had kind of changed, got rid of a lot of ailments, from depression to physical ailments, and he swears by it now. And then you have other people at completely the other end of the spectrum talking about kind of complete, like, whole food plant-based diet, to like just forks over knives, and
yes,
different documentaries and people in that community. And then there's the things like paleo and ketone diets, and like where's the truth? It just seems that there's so much confusion, and in that confusion, a lot of people can make a lot of money by preying on people's confusion and vulnerability. What are your from a nutritionist, that your scientific nutritionist knowledge and background? What are your thoughts on all those diets?
I think for me, I come from a background of functional medicine, and also a background of personalized nutrition. So for me, that means looking at the person and what's going on for the person. And I think when it comes to food choices, there's three things that I would say to people in terms of trying to make a decision around that. Number one is, there is no one size diet that fits all. It doesn't exist. You will inevitably encounter people that say, oh, but they tried paleo and it was brilliant for them. He tried ketogenic diet and it was amazing for him. You know, we are all biochemically individual, and we are all very unique in that aspect. So what's going on for you is very different to what's going on for me, and what nutrients you need is very different to what I need. So that's the first thing that I always say, is there is no such thing. I wish there was. I wish it was easy for me to say, this is the one that works for everyone, you know, hands down. Doesn't happen that way.
I think the problem is, I know you have a couple of things more to say, but I think the problem is that the militant way that people on the internet talk about this stuff, like, is it, like, there's people that, like, there doesn't seem to be a lot of compassion. And like, you know, I tried this and this was fantastic.
Yes.
It's like, I tried this, it works for me, and you're not doing it, so you're a loser kind of thing. There just seems to be a huge amount of that.
Yeah, there is. And I mean, I'm so, I guess, grateful from the point of view of having done marketing in my previous life. So it's just, I'm very, very attuned to that. I'm very, very aware of the next fad diet or the next big thing, you know, unless it's backed up by a huge amount of research, then, it, you know, and depends on what. And that, I suppose, brings me into my second point, is it defining what your health goals are is hugely important to determining what foods you're going to eat. You know, because if you're looking at things like, if there's a family history, for example, of Alzheimer's, or if there's a family history of type 2 diabetes or cancers or whatever's in your gene pool, it's very, very important that you look at that and try and prevent it right now if you can, and try and put in the right nutrients, put in the right foods that you can to avoid that situation. So that would be a big thing that I would say as well, is define what you want from health. And the other thing that I would say on that is, a lot of people equate health with a lean waistline. So a lot of people equate their health, like, so for example, for me in January, the big thing is new year, new you, like, you know, leaner waistline, all of those kind of things. But for me, from my point of view, there's a huge amount more going on with your health rather than just your waistline. So think about your skin health, think about your mental health, think about your energy production. Are you able to get out of bed in the morning? Are you able to play with your kids? Are you able to walk up the stairs without being out of breath? Weight is the byproduct of an imbalance. So for me, it's thinking about other aspects of your health, or thinking about your health in totality. How do you feel? That would be a second point. And my third thing is, when you're trying to make a decision around food and make a decision around what diet you want to go on or what lifestyle you want to do, how do you feel on your current diet? That would be a big thing that I would jot down, and I'd write down, how is it working for you? So do you feel well? Do you feel happy? Do you feel like you get your 8 hours sleep? Do you feel bloated every time you eat? Are you able to move your body very, very well? Or are you very, very stiff and immobile and things like that? So again, look at how you currently feel, and then you're in a better position to start to make changes. Rather than just going, oh, I'll try that for no apparent reason and see how I go, you know. So defining that can be quite good for people as well.
And how should, so just to pick a couple of things at random there, or a couple of things that struck me, how, in terms of measuring how you feel, how do you go about measuring how you feel? Or is there practical things that you can do to measure that or track that, or what would you suggest?
In terms of your mood or in terms of energy?
When you said all of that. When you said about that, the third thing you mentioned about kind of how do you feel in your current diet, like, you know, your energy production, your sleep, your mood, like the mood, flexibility, whatever it is.
Yes.
Like, you know, is it literally something that is kind of like, you know, of keeping a journal, measuring, like what would you suggest?
So there's various different markers that you can use to test. But for example, things that people can do right now and going forward is, sleep is keep a sleep journal. And a lot of people have wearable devices now that they wear on the wrist that tracks their sleeping performance. And, you know, even jotting that down, or it'll give you a graph and show you, okay, so from Monday to Saturday, I slept for 6 hours, and then on Sunday, I slept for 10, whatever it is. And look at the patterns and look at that and actually analyze that data. Is there any way as well you can extrapolate different pieces of information and go, okay, so on Tuesday, I only slept for 4 hours. It was very broken. I did have a cup of tea and 4 biscuits before I went to bed. Is there anything you can change around the behaviors that you know, before you go to bed that night? So looking at that that data and kind of analyzing it a bit further and digging a bit deeper and seeing if there's anything there that you can change. In relation to weight, the biggest thing that I always say to people in measurement is your clothes. Scales differ, particularly bathroom scales and things like that. Or if you are getting your body mass index or your body composition done, you will usually do it every 4 weeks or every 8 weeks, you know, so it's not something that will change quite quickly. So what I always say to people is pick a pair of trousers or a shirt or something like that you haven't maybe worn and see how it fits on you and keep an eye that way. If it's mental health, then, you know, track your mood, track how do you feel, write it down. And I'm a big believer in writing things down. It's huge, because once it's on paper, it's very doable, it's achievable, and it's something that you can figure out if you need to change. So that's how I would always say in those kind of things. Like, I mean, there's obvious things like blood tests if you want to check vitamin D levels and calcium and all of those kind of things. That's absolutely apparent and very, very beneficial. But if you're looking for something in terms of your mood or sleep or those kind of things, I would definitely jot them down. And there's loads of journals out there that you can use and templates. But if not, just buy a little notebook and just write stuff down. It makes it a lot easier. And that's when you're in a position and you have the power then to go, okay, so I'm only sleeping actually 3 nights out of 7. And then you can go, what do I need to do to change that?
And what, when you say this, in that example, you mentioned earlier about there's no one size fits all around nutrition. Is there a one size fits all ballpark around sleep, or what's a typical, or what is recommended amount of sleep that we should get?
Typically between 7 and 8 hours we should be getting of good quality sleep. And that is, it's very hard for some people to achieve. And that is harder for some people to achieve physiologically because of kids and young kids and being fed during the night and things like that. But generally speaking, outside of that, we should be getting a good 7 to 8 hours of rested sleep. The problem lies in either the getting to sleep or the wakening up during the night, the broken sleep. But there's also a huge amount then on the other side of that when you're waking up and you don't actually feel rested. So you're not actually detoxifying properly during the night. So again, there's a huge amount there that you can look at in terms of the fuel that you're putting into your body. Are you not putting in the right nutrients? And a lot as well is your behavior before you go to bed. So I always say sleep is twofold. It's your nutrition and physiologically, but it's also your sleep hygiene. So are you, you know, on a screen? Are you on a laptop? Are you on a tablet right up until you go to bed, or even in your bed? Is there a blue light there that's been emitted that's causing you not to unwind and calm down? Because we're built that we should unwind naturally when it gets dark, and various different chemicals are released to help us then go to sleep, melatonin being the one, to help us relax and unwind and sleep. And if you're interrupting that constantly with a blue light or a phone or a tablet or whatever it is, you know, you're stopping that process and you're not sleeping very well then. So
okay, so on that one, and I know like this is great, this is like 360 degrees, fantastic. On the melatonin and the kind of that sleep hormone kind of emission from it, like I've often heard, or you hear people saying, kind of like, you know, to leave that 1 hour or 2 hours without technology before bedtime, to allow your body to sleep. From a kind of hormonal or scientific level, what is actually happening there?
So you're allowing then the production of melatonin, you're allowing that process to happen, and that will happen in your gut function as well. So if you it's stimulated by the pineal gland in the back of your head. So if you have a laptop or a phone or something like that, your body is automatically wired to, we work by the circadian rhythm, so when it starts to get darker, we start to naturally unwind, and then that whole process happens. But if we have that blue light from the pineal gland, it stimulates, it interrupts, and it breaks that cycle. So that's when it becomes a stress on your body. That's when it becomes problematic for you to deal with. And it's harder then for you to, you know, be in a nice relaxed position and induce a good quality sleep. So that's for me, definitely leaving technology away for at least 1 hour if you can. Definitely no less than half an hour. But definitely try and do it for 1 hour, and do things that help you unwind as well. So sitting in front of a TV is not relaxing, you know. So even if it's just picking up a regular book and reading, or having a bath, or soaking your feet, or, you know, whatever it is, writing in a journal, whatever that may be, or meditating, you know, those kind of things that will actually actively help you relax is really, really important, because we live in such a stressed environment. You know, we're constantly being marketed to or talked to, or we're constantly contactable as well, and, you know, so it's looking at ways that you can kind of almost disconnect from a lot of that technology and just kind of allow yourself the space.
Yes, Twitter is my favorite one, but I have a hate relationship with lots of social media. I have a love hate relationship with Twitter. But I went onto Twitter at the weekend, and within about 10 minutes, I basically had come across the death of democracy in Britain, the death of democracy in America, and there was a third kind of cataclysmic event. So like I was kind of exposed to all this horrible stuff, or terrible stuff about the world, from my home in rural Ireland, just from checking my social feeds.
Exactly, and the stress that puts on your
mental, totally. I felt in a terrible mood straight away.
Yeah,
I mean, now I'm lucky that I was able to recognize that.
It was
really bad for my mood straight away.
100%. And a lot of the time people get up straight away and they're in reactive mode. So they get up, they check their phone, they check their emails, and they instantly go, crap, I didn't do that. Oh my God, I have to do that. Oh my God. So they're already catching their tail when they're getting up. And that can cause you to be a very, very, it just creates a huge amount more cortisol and stress in the body. So again, looking at ways and practices that you can kind of start your day a little bit calmer as well, and even end your day on that note as well, is very beneficial.
And so from a nutrition point of view, like so we're kind of we've talked in around sleep and how, and like it's so vitally important to everything. Like I know if I kind of peel back the layers of the onion, like if it's always like it's always that if I'm having bad days or bad time, but like, you know, it's kind of often that I just had a bad night's sleep, or I wasn't getting rested, I wasn't getting recharged. From a nutrition point of view around sleep, like in terms of what we should be thinking about for maybe the second half of the day, or even like in the morning time kind of after sleep, what should we be taking in kind of in the first couple of hours of the day to kind of leave ourselves in a good position, good energy for the day? What either side of that, have you any recommendations?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, a huge amount of your sleep ability and I guess quality will come from the health of your gut and the health of the nutrients that you're giving it. I always equate our diet to a car, because I think it's a very easy analogy for people to understand. If you have a diesel car and you put petrol in it, it splutters, it doesn't work, it doesn't function. My biggest thing is functionality. If you put diesel into a diesel car, it works, it goes, perfect, not a bother. So again, look at what you're putting into your body, and this is answering your question. So I guess in terms of the latter portion of the day, looking at things like that are higher in sugar, that are more stimulatory. So caffeine, high sugar treats like, you know, the croissant or the coffee and the muffin or the, you know, the 4 o'clock Mars bar, whatever it is, a 3 p.m. slump. Look at those kind of foods and see if there's anything that you can put in that's a slower release sugar, that's a more natural form of food. So again, looking at fruits and vegetables, looking at slow release carbohydrates, and looking at removing the caffeine, which is the biggest stimulant. And a lot of people react differently to caffeine. So some people, it can be the fourth cup of coffee that sends them over the edge, and the other person, it can be like the half cup of coffee that they're actually, you know, shaking and reacting to it. So again, look at your reaction around caffeine as well. If it is something that affects you, then I would definitely have it towards the start of the day rather than at the end of the day. And caffeine is a whole other issue as well, depending on the person that comes to see me. Either I'll completely get rid of it or I won't. But it's one of those things that people love and really, really want to take. So as long as you're taking it in the right way in terms of not using it as your energy source.
Ideal world, would we not have taken, like if all things been equal, would you recommend just not taking caffeine?
No, I don't think there's any harm in caffeine. Okay. I suppose for me, if someone comes to me though with adrenal fatigue and is completely stressed out and they're using that as their energy source, that's their fuel, then I have to take them off it, because they're completely burning out their adrenal glands, they're suffering with adrenal exhaustion, and they're not being able to create their own energy.
What's adrenal exhaustion?
So adrenals are little glands that sit in the top of our kidneys, and they help us produce a huge amount more energy.
Okay.
So when we're using the coffee and when we're using the caffeine as our source of energy, we're using it incorrectly. If you're, you know, getting up in the morning, you're having your breakfast, and then you have a cup of coffee just because you love the taste of it, then that's absolutely perfect. There's no problem there. But if you're using it to function, that's when you have issues. So that would be the situation that I would take it off the person. That and things like fizzy drinks, anything very, very high sugar, because again, you're just causing more stress and more oxidation and more inflammation in the body as well. So looking at trying to reduce that as much as possible.
And so you spoke about sugars, and the, I suppose it's kind of artificial sugars that are refined sugars or baked goods or whatever.
Yes, absolutely.
There is a I remember talking to somebody, and they wouldn't eat grapes because the amount of sugar in the grapes. But is that something to think about, or is it like are the sugars in, say, fruit and veg that completely different to your refined sugar?
Yeah, there is. So again, you have your processed sugars, which are your things like you know, your obviously your table sugar, and then you have your fizzy drinks in terms of beverages, and then you have your pastries and cakes and sweets and all of those confectionery foods. Then obviously you have your plant-based sugars, your whole food-based sugars. So that encompasses your fruits, your vegetables, and a lot of carbohydrates. So carbohydrates are things that will convert to sugar in your body.
Okay.
So you will have various different forms of those. So, you know, quick and simple carbohydrates will be things like white bread, white pasta. They will convert to sugar quite quickly. Then you have the more complex varieties. So you have things like oats, brown rice, brown pasta, wholemeal breads. They'll convert to sugars, but slower. So it's not a quick insulin release. In relation to grapes and things like that, if you're a diabetic, absolutely. I will take you off those things like grapes and pineapples and mangoes, those things that are higher in the sugars. But if you're able to tolerate them and your sugars are fairly regular, then absolutely there's no problem. But again, it's in context of everything else that you're eating. If you're, you know, giving up the McDonald's and you're substituting it with like a punnet of grapes a night, again, that's not, you know, a very, very good thing either. And it's also looking at people that remove the chocolate bar and then they go to dates and figs and the dried fruit, and they're eating a huge handful of that as well. So again, it's portion control around that, but it's also looking at, you know, trying to reduce that as a huge amount as well, because it is sugar, it still is sugar. Then you have the vegetable side of things, which is perfect. So you have like, they're lower in sugar, and a lot of the time you can eat a huge amount of the vegetables without that spike.
You've mentioned the, even when you're talking about sleep, you mentioned kind of how vital, important the gut is for this, and that's a lot of your study background as well.
Tell us a little bit, if you can, about the important, like how the gut works for it in the context of your whole body and your energy and your productivity and wherever you are. Like, tell us a little bit about what the gut does.
So the gut is huge. So the gut will digest, absorb, assimilate, excrete various different things. So the assimilation of nutrients is your ability to, from the food that you eat, you digest it, and the gut actually, it begins in the mouth. You know, so right. Once you start to chew your food, you will notice that there'll be a huge amount of saliva in your mouth, and that's breaking down all of your food. That's filled with enzymes, and that really, really helps to break down the food and help it travel. So that's hugely, hugely important. And a lot of people, they'll just, you know, shovel food in without that mastication process, which is very, very vital and very, very important for digestion. It helps us to send various different messages to the brain to start then releasing more juices, so that then the food is further digested down into a bolus. And it's at that point then that it's assimilated, all the nutrients are taken, and then they're transported around the system and things like that. So if there's a compromise in your digestive system, you will know about it fairly quickly, because, you know, and by compromise, I mean things like if you eat something and you instantly feel like your stomach is distended, and you instantly feel that bloated sensation where you pop a pin in your stomach and it would feel like it would explode. So that means you're not digesting foods properly. The other biggest signs and symptoms would be things like constipation, so not moving your bowels every single day. And I think just to clear that up a little bit, I mean, constipation is not moving your bowels every day. So if it's every second day, that would be definitely a form of constipation as well, because, you know, people would come to me and say, no, I'm not constipated. It would be like maybe every second or third day. If you're not going every day, you are constipated. So again, it's looking at that pattern and recognizing that and seeing what ways you can then achieve more regular stools. And then on the other side of that, if there's a faster transit time, you're looking at things like diarrhea. Generally, that'll happen with, you know, food poisoning or those kind of things, but it can happen in terms of IBS and various different triggers to affect that. So the gut health is fundamental, because there's a huge amount that actually happens in the gut. Aside from the food that you give it, there's a huge amount of nutrients and vitamins and minerals that are manufactured there, hormones, all of those kind of things. So if you have an imbalance in that, then it has a huge knock-on effect on the rest of the body. So again, it's very, very important that we get the gut. It's kind of like our powerhouse. So if we have any of those symptoms, if we're constipated, if we're sluggish, if we have diarrhea, if we're bloated, if we have reflux, which is upper GI, then again, you're looking at not having the right nutrients to function correctly.
Okay, and so how do we, without getting professional help, and I do recommend it.
Yeah, yeah.
How do we go about ensuring that we are getting the right nutrients in to allow our gut to operate at the level that we want it to operate at?
The biggest thing is that I would get people to do first and foremost is to sit down and figure out how your current diet is affecting you. How do you feel? If it is, because in that way you can then make decisions. So if it's every third night you have pasta and you instantly your stomach is really, really, you know, bloated, or you don't seem to deal with it well, then that's really good information. So we can then look at maybe eliminating that and putting something else in to see if that helps the process. So the biggest thing that I would say to people is write down how you feel currently. And then the other big thing to look at for digestion and for good health is lots and lots of fresh vegetables. Vegetables are key because they're loaded with vitamins and minerals. They're loaded with things like magnesium, and magnesium is brilliant because it relaxes. So if you have a very spasmodic bowel in terms of IBS, you have it's constantly going between constipation and diarrhea or cramping or any of those kind of things, then you're looking at putting in magnesium. You're looking at something there to relax the bowel. So again, fresh fruit and vegetables, but mostly dark green leafy vegetables. So try and include something green every day if you can, be it in a smoothie, be it in your side salad in your dinner, be it in lettuce on a sandwich, whatever it is, try and make that an aim if you can add something green every day. The other thing that I would look at is fermented foods, or foods that have a culture or a bacteria in them, to help to increase the good bacteria. That will differ for everyone, but this is a general topic. So I would say things like kimchi, things like miso, things like sauerkraut. And again, you can get them more readily available than you think in the likes of Dunnes and Tesco and Super Value, definitely health food stores. They're a little bit more expensive in terms of the jar, but you can, you know, it'll be €5 or €6 for a jar, but that will last you for a while. So again, just adding that little bit of the pickled cabbage or whatever it is to your dinner, fantastic in terms of the nutrition value as well, and very, very important for gut health. So those would be the two big things. So looking at the foods that you're putting in and trying to see if there is anything that triggers things for you. So what are your triggers? Generally, the big triggers can be, they can be gluten, they can be dairy, they can be caffeine, they can be sugar, but never underestimate stress. Because a lot of the time, if you get that, you know, you will hold a lot of it in your gut in terms of that butterfly feeling or that stressful feeling. You will always hold it in your gut and that stress. So again, looking at ways that you can either reduce that in your life or looking at ways if you can put in like foods that won't add to that. So sugar is the big one that will add to that.
Okay, okay. And before we leave the gut, talk to us a little bit, if you can, about the... Because I think you might have been one of the first people I heard mentioning this, and I took it seriously. The relationship between, you know, the gut health and mental health, like what's going on in the body there that kind of is connecting one to the other.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're connecting, the gut and the brain is a bidirectional system, and it's connected via the vagus nerve. And a lot of the time, if you have imbalances in your gut function in terms of, and by imbalances again I mean things like constipation, diarrhea, bloated, reflux, all of those, you will then have an imbalance in brain health as well. So you can have things like yeast overgrowth in the gut, and then you can have things like brain fog, and you know, and they would be very you would have a lot of that, you'd have that together. So it's looking at ways that you can improve the health of the gut and fuel the brain correctly. A lot of the time you're just looking at removing a lot of the crap. So a lot of the processed sugars, foods, I think the easiest, and Michael Pollan came up with 3 food rules, and the easiest thing to think about is eat real food, not too much, and mostly plants. So real food is always stick to the outer aisles of the supermarkets. It's fresh fruit and vegetables. It's, you know, it's meat. It's unprocessed dairy. It is raw nuts and seeds, all of those kind of things. And again, then you're looking at, you know, lots of fruit, lots of veg, but removing all of the sugars. So removing all of the things that are, you know, detrimental to your health, like the cakes, the sweets, the biscuits, the processed stuff. You know, they taste amazing, but they're not good for your health and they're not good for your brain function. So not too much then is his other food rule, and that looks at your portion control. So again, you know, in terms of eating, I feel we consume a huge amount of foods, and I feel that we're being made think that we need to snack a huge amount when in actual fact we don't. I think as a society, we can't coexist with hunger very well. And I don't like that idea anymore, that it's like, oh, like I would question the amount of people that feel hungry in terms of, in our society. You will always grab a snack bar, you'll grab something, you know, but it's very infrequent that we would experience a lot of hunger. And I think, like, and that probably will bring us into a little bit around intermittent fasting and things like that. But definitely looking at that, about looking at not eating too much, not like looking at your portions and making sure that they're adequate and they're proper. So something that I would always say to people is get, you know, if everyone works in offices, they have the 200ml water cooler cup. That's your cooked portion of carbohydrate, for example. You know, using that as a guide. And a lot of the time people will come to me and say, well, I have about 3 or 4 times that in my evening meal, you know. So looking at, if you can reduce that and add in more fruit and veg, then, you know, you won't even notice the, you know, your plate won't look devoid of food. But looking at ways that you can try and, you know, consume a little bit less than you were.
Very interesting to get your thoughts on intermittent fasting. But before we go there, it's hard for people. It's hard to make a lot of times people know, logically or rationally, they know, like, you know, I need to maybe reduce my portion size. Is it something that just needs to be kind of a step that just needs to be taken, or is there some like, do you recommend kind of doing that gradually over a period of time, or what do you recommend?
It depends, and I think I definitely draw on your TED talk that you did before in relation to happiness and things like that. The biggest thing that I would always say is take action, is do something. If it's small, it doesn't matter. Is it you're doing something to further that goal? Because a lot of the time we procrastinate. We're like, oh, and classically in terms of weight loss, I'm starting on Monday. And, you know, it's Wednesday now. Why not start now? You know, those kind of things. So it's looking at ways that you can actually just take that step. If it is the case of reducing your pasta, don't overwhelm yourself. Don't try and, you know, change everything in one day. Just take one small thing. Just fix your breakfast first, or fix your dinner first, or fix the snack at 3 o'clock. Or, you know, for example, it could be sugar and tea. I mean, I had a guy that came into me the other day, and he said, oh no, I don't take a huge amount of sugar. I would take maybe, you know, 2 teaspoons in a cup of tea. And I says, well, how many cups of tea do you have? And he says, I have about 10 a day. So, I mean, that's 20 teaspoons of sugar. That's a huge amount. So his biggest goal there, outside of anything else that was going on for him, was to reduce that by 1 teaspoon every day. That was it. You know, so again, look at ways that you can start something and develop it and grow it, and then it solidify it into your habits, and that becomes your practice.
Yeah, absolutely. And so on intermittent fasting, I hear a lot of people, and again, the self-experimentation community online, and it's something I've never done it. Mm. Maybe psychologically, I feel like I need to eat something quite early in the morning, but I've never done it. But I've heard a lot of people talking about kind of the what was it 18-6, or like the 18-hour fast in the day, 6 hours eating, or maybe it was 16-8, something along those lines. But kind of having that window between say 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. or 12 noon to 6 p.m. wherever, with that, and they eat all their daily allowance during those times. What are your thoughts on that from a nutritional point of view?
From a nutrition point of view, it's receiving a huge amount of I guess coverage at the moment. And in research, there's been a huge amount in terms of, you know, mice models and things like that, and in the context of diabetes, specifically type 2 diabetes. So again, there is quite a lot, and that is it's coming into play now. The easiest way probably to start and to look at intermittent fasting is doing it from, you know, your last evening meal to your breakfast in the morning. So even if you can only do 12 hours, I think that's brilliant. So if you have, you know, your dinner at 7 p.m. and then you have your breakfast at 7, like that's 12 hours. That's really, really good. And then you can start to slowly increase that if you need to. The biggest benefit of intermittent fasting is it's giving your body a chance to utilize and absorb the nutrients that it has already and heal in a way, because our bodies are designed to heal themselves, you know, as much as they can. So by not putting in the various different chemicals or toxins or different additives or foods, then it's in a better position. It gives itself that space and time to do so. From a logical point of view, that's what's kind of going on, or physiological, sorry. So for me, if there was someone coming to me with type 2 diabetes, it would be something that I would either introduce as in a low carb diet, or looking at that intermittent fasting, but starting, you know, slow. So starting at 12 hours and then maybe going to 14 if you can push it. And then as you develop and get into it, you know, you can see that you will go up to maybe 16 hours, and then it's not that you gorge then for 6 hours. You'll actually find that your body doesn't need a huge amount of food and calories at that point as well. So it's sustaining yourself then at that point. But yeah, there's it's a very, very interesting topic. It is something that I would definitely look at. And, you know, because I think sometimes for me, fasting is more beneficial than eating a processed food, because you're getting no nutrition from it. It's only causing inflammation, it's causing stress, it's causing oxidation. So again, looking at ways that you can try and reduce that, and intermittent fasting can be one of those things.
I was very interested to hear you talk about hunger, and how we were rarely ever hungry. In a lot of cases, we might not even know what hunger really feels like.
Yes.
And so within that and intermittent fasting, like do you put much stock in kind of, you know, calorie allowances or calorie counts for the day? And the reason I ask is that I'm doing a little bit just of food tracking at the moment with the MyFitnessPal app.
Yes.
And it's given me my allowance or my recommended calorie intake of, like, you know, 2,600 per day for my height and weight and age and various things. And I've discovered that I'm struggling to reach that without kind of, like, I could reach it by eating crap food.
Yes.
But I don't want to do that. So do you put much stock in kind of calorie counts or stuff like that?
It very much depends on who's in front of me. So if it's an athlete and they're trying to reach and they're trying to hit a target in terms of performance or speed or things like that, then we will look at that in terms of their fuel. I find it's a very, very helpful tool for people to understand their macronutrients, for people to understand how much carbohydrate they're actually eating and how much protein they're actually eating, because then you can make huge changes when you know. So for example, you could be having like a diet that's 60% carbohydrate and only 15% fats, you know. So again, looking at that is massively important in terms of the information that it gives you. And particularly on MyFitnessPal, I find that really, really beneficial that you can see the content of everything, you know, and you're able to use that.
Yeah, it's only the last couple of weeks I've been paying attention to it, and it's like, I probably, before about a year ago, I'd never heard of the term macros. Like, but when I was in the US at one stage, and all the kind of the powerlifting community, some of the young guys are lifting kind of big weights in the gym, and they're talking, like, they had this full blown conversation that I was kind of on the edge of at one stage.
Yes.
Talking about their macros, and I was like, I actually it was like another language. I didn't know what they were talking about.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, so in terms of my MyFitnessPal app recommends is like, and it's obviously very ballpark, but it's like, you know, 50% carbs, 30% fats, 20% protein. Does that kind of stack up for you, or like in terms of there's obviously there's good carbs and bad carbs you can have, and there's maybe good protein and bad protein, or
absolutely, and it'll come down to that. And this is probably one of the most important sentences is that not all calories are created equally. So you know if you're taking a broad spectrum of it, you can look at a can of Coke, and you can also look at a bucket of broccoli or an avocado, and they may have similar calories, but they're completely different nutritionally. One is very nutrient dense, and the other is just sugar and empty calories. So again, you're looking at the density of the nutrition, and you're looking at that first and foremost, more so than the actual calorie count. You know, I think that's the most important point to make to people, is that calories they are important, but it's the nutrient density of the calorie that's more important than the actual number, if that makes sense. Aside from that, then when you're getting into deeper in relation to your macronutrient content in terms of, you know, your carbohydrates, your proteins, your fats, you're absolutely right. There are bad carbs that you can be eating, and there are bad proteins and fats that you can be eating. So again, it's looking at the most nutritious forms of those and getting those into the diet. So looking at your complex carbohydrates, you know, your quinoa, your brown rice, your sweet potatoes, those kind of things. And then you're also looking at your proteins, your fats, your meats, your chicken, your nuts and seeds, your lentils, your beans, if you're vegetarian or vegan. And then you're looking at fats. So you're looking at avocados, you're looking at salmon, you're looking at walnuts, all of those, chia seeds, you know, those kind of things, butter, milk. They're very, very important. So again, it's looking at what you're trying to achieve, and also looking at the ratios of those. But for me, that differs between different people. It's not something that I can, you know, categorically go, it's 50, 20, 30, it depends on what you're trying to achieve as well.
But it's good, I guess, to have an understanding.
It's brilliant. And I love that, because MyFitnessPal is so accessible to everyone. It's really, really easy to use, and it gives you an understanding of, oh my God, I was having this amount of carbohydrate. No wonder I was, you know, feeling really tired during the day, or wasn't breaking it down very well.
Yeah.
Or was that wee bit more sluggish before my workout or something like that. So it gives you that information to then make further decisions, which,
yes,
I think is important.
Absolutely, yeah, very interesting. I want to talk, because I know you do a little bit, you do a lot of work around families with autistic children, and I think that, like, I'll let you kind of explain that, or kind of the role of a nutritionist in autism, and to preface that, I suppose, by, I've listened to a couple of interviews with a doctor in the US called Dr. Zach Bush, who's on the Rich Roll podcast a couple of times, and just he's a really, really fascinating individual, and he talks about one of his big things is about soil
depletion.
Nutrients and soil depletion and soil regeneration, and how so much of what we've done in terms of industrial farming around the world has killed so much topsoil, which has killed so much nutrients, which is what the foods that we're getting are nutrient devoid of nutrients in a lot of cases. And he makes reference to the things like the explosion in autoimmune disease, the explosion in diabetes, in chronic illnesses. And one of the things he mentions is that the explosion since about the 1970s in the number of autistic children or children born on autistic spectrum. And the figures that he was talking about were that if that continues to grow, go in the same direction it's going to be by 2030, it's going to be one in every three children born on the autism spectrum. So I just wanted to get, like, is that something you're like, what's your kind of perspective on all of that, or in the work you're doing with families with autistic children as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually huge. And, you know, a lot of the time I will talk about toxins and talk about things like that, even outside of the autism community. And people will say to me, I wouldn't have a huge amount of toxins in my life. You know, I don't smoke, or, you know, I don't drink, or those kind of things. But we are exposed to so many different toxins that we're just not aware of, particularly in personal care products, particularly in, you know, like, obviously things like shampoo, conditioners, makeup for females. And, you know, there's a huge perfumes, all of those kind of things that we're actually, and our skin is super porous. So, you know, we will ingest all of that. And it's our body's ability then to break that down and get rid of it and excrete it. And if we have a really, really stressed out body, if we're working a really high stress job, we're not sleeping very well, I mean, we have imbalances there, and that's not properly being excreted. So again, it's dealing with all of that outside of autism. But he's absolutely right, and something I do completely believe as well, is that particularly in America, you have a huge amount of things like glyphosate and all of those toxins, which are hugely, hugely impactful in terms of, you know, the foods that we're eating and our ability to get nutrients from them. So that, you know, a lot of the things in the US are GMO and they're sprayed, you know, and we're not as exposed to things like that, but we do have a huge amount of toxins as well that we do have to deal with. And a story that I often tell is I went, and I love Granny Smith apples, and I went to get a pack just into a local greengrocer, and I noticed, I was like, oh, they're awfully shiny. They were super shiny, like I could almost see my reflection in them. And I says, that there's something about that to me that wasn't natural. And I took them home and I kind of wiped them as I do, and it didn't come off or it didn't fade. So I steeped them in a small bit of water and apple cider vinegar, and there was on the part that was submerged in water, there was a massive big ring around the outside of it, and it was literally, when I took it off, it was like a glue substance. It was completely like a wax, obviously, that they had put on to shine. But having just eaten the apple, if I had been on the go, you know, I probably would have eaten it no bother. But when you think about the size of that and the amount of that, and that going into my body, and my body going, I have no idea what this is, it's a toxin, it's something I don't know what it is, so I have to use extra energy to process it and try and get rid of it, and maybe isn't able to, and is stored then in a fat cell, you know. So again, looking at our ability to get rid of things is huge. So the biggest thing, I think, for me in terms of the autism community, what I look at is I look at toxin exposure, but I also look at their gut health. And that's the biggest thing, because inevitably people come to me with, you know, constipation, and it's fairly, fairly bad constipation, and also things like megarectum. And a lot of the time they're on, you know, suppositories, or they're on huge, like, you know, laxatives or things like that. So it's looking at ways that we can improve the functionality in that gut and in that child. And you will then find that behavior improves. You'll find that sleep improves. You'll find that their ability to process things actually improves. When you can get a little bit more functionality there, you're working with that. There's a lot as well in terms of, you know, being exposed to maybe 20 or 30 courses of antibiotics in their lives as well. Completely wipes out, you know, all of their good bacteria as well. Antibiotics are great, they get rid of the bacteria, but they also get rid of all of our good bacteria. So you're looking at having to replenish all of those stores as well, try and build that up. And good bacteria is so, so important in terms of cognition, in terms of gut health as well. So looking at ways that you can improve the functionality of that, getting rid of the yeast and adding in the nutrients then that would classically be deficient. So looking at B6 for processing processing things, emotions, environments, things like that, looking at zinc again, so opening up that taste bud, opening up, you know, various different chemical processes in the body, and looking then at, you know, their ability to detoxify things, which is called their methylation pathway. So all of those in context, the biggest thing that I'm looking at with that community is functionality, trying to improve the function of that gut so that they're healthier, happier, and a little bit more engaged in their world, because that's the biggest thing, is the connection, being able to connect with your child, for them to look you in the eyes, for them to understand and comprehend and, you know, reciprocate is massive for families, and that's something that, you know, you're just trying to improve upon every day.
Before we wrap up, it's been fascinating talking to you. There's just so much information and wisdom in there that I've scratched the surface of it. but what are you excited about right now? What's your 2019 looking like and beyond?
I think for me, the biggest thing that I'm excited about is I am obsessed with the power of foods. I'm obsessed with foods. I love food, but I love the power of it. I love what it can do. And I think for me, bringing that to the world or bringing that to various different people and communities is something that I strive to do. And, you know, I'm always the one at parties, I guess, that, you know, I'm often, you know, described as the food police, and, you know, like, oh, I wouldn't, you know, don't eat that or whatever. I don't do that. I'm not a judger, but I will be very aware of what I put into my own body and how nutritious it is and how it can help me, I suppose, be a better person. But I think the biggest thing for people is to, you know, love the food they eat. Don't think about food as, you know, think about the beneficial aspect of food rather than it just filling a void and rather than it just getting you from one meeting to the next, and, you know, taking your time sitting down. And one thing that I absolutely love, and a friend of mine is from Greece, is the Mediterranean style of eating. Everything is a celebration, every meal, and it gets everyone together. And I'd love to, you know, get that back for people, because, you know, inevitably we'll sit in front of a dinner or TV, or we'll just not communicate during food, or we'll just be, you know. And I think that is so, so important. So it's, you know, making it a place of both nourishment but also connection and communication as well. And I think that kind of draws into the power of what it can do. So yeah, for me, food is just, food is medicine, as Hippocrates was saying, and I think that's so true.
Amazing. It's a wonderful place to finish, except there's one question that I didn't ask and I would like to explore it very, very briefly, which is food labelling.
Yes.
It's something that is there stuff missing? Like, it's obviously a lot more advanced than it was maybe 5, 10, 15 years ago, but yes. is it telling us enough, or what are practical tips that we can do to kind of to be able to read or get the information we need?
Yes, and I think for me, I would like if there was a little bit more education around the biggest criminal in our food world today, I guess, is sugars. And I would like if there's a little bit more transparency around what actually is a sugar on label. So you'll have things like dextrose, you'll have things like mannose, you'll have things like maltol, you'll have various different sugars. And I think there's about 61 different forms of them, and people don't know what they are. They're just a word, you know. So again, I'd love if there's a little bit more transparency around that, and a little bit more about this is a sugar and this is being converted into sugar in your body and it's not beneficial for you. So because everyone's very familiar with things like honey and agave, and, you know, that's quite a high sugar as well, but high fructose corn syrup, all of those kind of things is coming in. It's massive in the US, it's not as big here, but again, trying to see if there's a little bit more transparency around that, I think, would be a big thing. Labeling is it's not bad. It'll tell you, you know, carbs, fats, proteins and things like that, but I do wish that for people is a little bit more education around that. And the other thing I would always say to people is look at the first ingredient. If the first ingredient is sugar, that means that that's the most prominent ingredient. So again, look at the order of the ingredient and see what's the most prominent. If it's a pork sausage and pork is number 4 on the list, there's not a huge amount of pork in it. So be very aware of what you're actually putting into your body.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that would be my biggest thing around that.
Excellent. Where can people go to find out more about Orla McLaughlin?
So they can go to healthbyorla.com, healthbyorla.ie, and you find me on Facebook and Instagram. Not a major Twitter person. I'm on there, but I'm not a major person. But, you know, you can communicate with me anyway like that, and I'll always get back.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Orla McLaughlin.
Thank you so much for having me. Delighted.